Shoot Them Down, The Flying Saucer Air Wars of 1952, an incredible story by Frank Fascino and also nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman. They're both next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, a double whammy for you tonight. Stanton Friedman, of course, worked as a nuclear physicist for the big companies, General Electric, GM, Westinghouse, TRW, Aerojet Giant, Nucleonics, McDonnell Douglas, all these big companies. He has often been referred to as the father of Roswell, the very first to investigate the incident beginning in 1978. And he is a dear friend of ours right here at Coast to Coast. Stanton, how are you?
In the morning, and it's 3 degrees outside, George.
Oh, my gosh, it's cold out there. Hey, you're the one who moved way up there.
Hey, I love it here in Fredericton. How can I not love a town that gives me a day of my own? August 27th was Stanton Friedman Day.
You got it. Well, our other friend, of course, Frank Fascino, became involved in UFO and crop circle research in West Virginia, has written just an incredible story, which you wrote the foreword to, Stanton.
And the epilogue.
And the epilogue. Shoot Them Down, The Flying Saucer Air Wars of 1952. Frank, of course, has also written The Braxton County Monster. Frank, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Hi, George. Great to be here.
We're going to have a great story here tonight. Frank, first of all, you and Stan have been working together for a long time now. How did that relationship start?
I met Stanton several years ago at a conference here in Florida, and I was talking to him about my Flatwoods Monster research. And we kept in touch on and off over the years, and at the 50th year anniversary festival that the town of Flatwoods was holding, Stanton came in as a special guest, and we had this little anniversary thing we put together for in the town. And Stanton actually went to the different points in the Flatwoods Monster incident where these events occurred, primarily the Bailey Fisher Farm where the Flatwoods Monster had landed. And Stanton became a little bit more interested once he was there at the different locations and actually understood the story a little bit more in depth.
So what you like to do, Frank, you pick up these incredible individual UFO cases and investigate them.
Yes. Yeah, I kind of stumbled onto this one by accident. I was visiting a relative in West Virginia who lived in Braxton County, and that's how I found out about the Flatwoods Monster incident.
Shoot Them Down, Stanton Friedman. How'd you get involved in this particular one?
Well, my focus is a little different from Frank's, and I'm big for going to government archives and looking at the cover-up, the cosmic Watergate, as I call it. And I couldn't help but be concerned about the events of 1952. Everybody who's gone seriously into looking at the UFO question knows 52 was the biggest year for Project Blue Book. There were flights over the White House. It was clear there was a government cover-up when the flights were explained away at a huge press conference as temperature inversions. And the Braxton County events of Flatwoods happened right, after the summer stuff, but still within a couple of months, and was part of an ongoing procedure, if you will, of the government lying, but also checking on UFOs, sending up planes after them and all of that. And when Frank's first book came out, we were attacked, both of us, since I was saying he did a good job. Some people said, hey, that's a terrible job. There weren't any dogfights between planes and UFOs. And so I called in the reserves and managed to dig out a whole bunch of stuff, thanks to the help of people who have huge clipping collections, that in that summer, orders had been given, you won't find this in the New York Times now, but orders had been given to military pilots to shoot them down, UFOs, if they don't land when instructed to do so. And so I followed up on those and managed at one of the archives to get access to a few reports, government investigative reports of aircraft accidents. And I should stress that these are darn hard to find. Now, the excuse given by the government, sometimes I think with justification, is they don't want to tell people about their investigation because they're afraid that the people involved when a plane crashes might not be very open because maybe some company will be sued for making a faulty part, you know, cover your butt kind of thing. But it was clear national security got involved. And when somebody keeps you from getting access to information, you begin to worry about it. Why do they do that? And then when we found out that there were so many aircraft that crashed and so many indications that our pilots were indeed trying to shoot them down, and because I lecture all over the place, I have heard seven examples of just the opposite happening, that is, more planes going after a UFO than came back down. So we got two things going. The pilots were instructed to shoot at the UFOs, but it appears that the UFO shot back, to put it in a crude sort of way. Maybe they zapped them with a death ray. Who knows what they
used. Who is the aggressor, Stan? What do you think?
I think there's no question that our planes were the aggressor. And I also ran across somebody. I did one of my MUFON journal columns about shoot them down. I got a call from a guy who told me that a good friend of his had reported to him in the early 50s that when flying in Europe, we'd lost 20 planes to UFOs.
20 planes?
Yeah, that's kind of scary stuff. And so, you know, there's no question we're dealing with the cosmic Watergate. I'm just working on a chapter of my new book, Flying Saucers and Science, going over some of the cosmic Watergate kind of stuff. And this is a part of the story we haven't really been told. I mean, everybody in ufology knows about the summer of 52. Not many have paid attention to the fact, as called out to me by my nephew when he was going through my MJ-12 stuff, Paul Kimball, a movie producer from Halifax, Dartmouth area, noted that there's a remark in the Eisenhower briefing document about great concern as events have picked up since May of 1952, this is. And it looks like this whole business was part of that. And it also looks like somebody by coincidence just sent me an article in Time magazine for June 9th, 1952, right at the beginning of this wave of activity. And in it, Dr. Donald Menzel, my favorite debunker, who worked for the government but we didn't know about it kind of thing, a major effort to debunk UFOs on June 9th. This is before he wrote his first book, which came out the next year. And I think he was programmed by Majestic 12 to, let's get the public off our backs. So there are a lot of things going on here, and I suspect we'll find that not only did this happen in conjunction with Flatwoods, but that there were other experiences around the country. Frank has dug out what happened up in Glastonbury, Frank?
Glastonbury, Connecticut. That was in 1952 also, George. It was August 5th. And Stanton got his hands on some of the microfilm reels that were recently declassified by the Norton Air Force Base accident reports of jet crashes and whatnot. And I went to him with a fine-tooth comb, and there's some mind-boggling information in there of ridiculous cover-ups of what were said to have happened. And in this particular case, August 5th, 1952, a jet crashed in South Glastonbury, Connecticut, just outside of Hartford. And I spent about a year going through the case. I went up to Glastonbury on several occasions, did on-field investigations, and went through all the reports. And what was released to the press in the New York Times is completely different from what was said to have happened in the accident report. Like, for instance, and Stanton and I have been talking about this for some time, the jet was said to have flamed out and run out of fuel when it crashed into the town, and it set about 150 to 200 yards of woods on fire. It exploded. There was shrapnel all over the place. The bullets had ignited, and the fire department couldn't get in. The woods were ablaze, but there was no fuel on board.
No fuel. So how could that happen?
Right? So we have a lot of discrepancies. Three fire departments were called out. It sounded, the resident said it sounded like an atomic bomb had exploded. The jet was in a million pieces, had split in half.
It was shot down.
Fire department couldn't get near the jet because the 50 caliber bullets were flying all over the place. There were hundreds of rounds, but it ran out of gas and crashed, George.
You sent me some copies of old newspaper clippings, Frank. One, the Seattle Post Intelligencer.
Right.
Another one, Fall River, I guess Massachusetts, was it?
That's correct.
I mean, incredible stories. One of the headlines says, Air Force orders jet pilots to shoot down flying saucers if they refuse to land. Now, of course, a defensive mechanism. They didn't know what these craft might be, but there it is, right in the Seattle newspaper.
And
well, there's also,
there's a Project Blue Book is loaded, George, with hundreds of cases about that between encounters with fighter jets and planes and UFOs. This isn't no secret. If you take the time and you go through it, it takes years to go through these documents. There's hundreds of cases of interactions between jets. And I went through the actual Project Blue Book unknown cases. And these unknown cases, I did a case study of just the 1950s, George, because that's the primary era we're working with.
Right.
So between 1950 and 1959, Project Blue Book actually listed 25 unknown cases that involved intercepted jets and flying saucers.
Now, were these jets, Frank, scrambled? Were they already up there and they spotted something? What happened here?
In a lot of cases, George, these jets were scrambled, but I also noticed that they were also on combat air patrol in several cases, which means that they were up there already. You know, if something was picked up, they were put up to, you know, for instance, like to patrol the perimeter of Washington. And they would stay up in the air and they would fly around for a while and then they would be targeted towards, you know, the UFO.
Now, I should stress that many years ago when I was speaking in McMinnville, Oregon, of all places, I met a guy who worked for the college, Linfield College, where I was speaking, and he wanted to talk to me in private. He had been at a radar station up in Montana, and they'd had a call from Canada, a UFO heading their way, and they had already a fighter, an interceptor in the sky, maneuvers, you know, standard, you got to fly to keep sharp, and they vectored him toward the unknown, and they were watching this whole thing on radar, and the two targets merged, and something left in a great hurry, and they never found the interceptor. I mean, and they knew exactly what altitude he was at, what direction he was going, how fast he was going, should have been able to find him. And he told me that after that, the orders went out, don't shoot, take pictures. This is years ago, and I thought of it as an isolated instance. Well, it appears it wasn't an isolated instance at all. And one of the reasons for our doing shows like yours, George, is with your great reach, it's not only to sell books. I mean, people sometimes accuse guys who go on the air, all you guys want to do is sell books. No, we're looking for witnesses. And, you know, it's like America's Most Wanted. You got to spread a wide net.
You sure do.
There are obviously people still alive who know about situations in which they were told to go after UFOs, pilots, and crew members on the ground. Remember, when you scramble a jet, somebody's in touch with him. The guy's on the ground, vector him in, there's feedback back and forth, a target at this location, I'm going at this velocity, et cetera. They don't say, hey, go up there and let me know what you find out sometime.
Yeah, I'll be at lunch. And it doesn't happen that way.
That's right. And so we're looking for people. I mean, my new book captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience with myself and Kathleen Martin, Betty's niece. We are looking for people, too, and there's an interesting parallel here, George. Military guys have been programmed to shut up, national security and so forth. People who've been abducted seem to have been programmed to shut up as well, a missing time part of that experience. And there are strong constrictions, in other words, in our society about not talking about the best cases. One, national security, the other, fear of ridicule. And I've said before on your show that I check my audiences typically 10%, this is at the end of my lecture, never at the beginning, believe they've seen something, but only 10% of them reported what they saw, primarily because of the fear of ridicule. But I get sightings from former military guys, and one guy in front of 1,350 people at East Texas State University, when I went through this little exercise, you know, have you seen one, and then did you report it, and then were you in the military at the time, and then you want to tell us about it? I can't. They told me not to say anything. It was a great line. I mean, I didn't know this guy. I didn't know what he was going to say. So we're trying to reach out. If they go to our websites, mine is www.stantonfriedman.com. There's contact information. It's listed on your website, too. Just check out my name. But we'd like to hear from people. And before it's too late, in other words, let's not take this secret to the grave. I mean, I'm still looking for Roswell incident.
Well, in the last hour here, Stanton will open up the phone lines also. You might hear from some additional people as well that way.
Okay. Well, you know, we got a big problem here, the UFO problem, and it's like an iceberg. Most of it's beneath the surface. Frank has found that's a big hunk of ice heading toward the Titanic here.
Absolutely. Now, we're coming up to the bottom here for this break, but Frank, let me ask you, 52 was a huge year for UFO sightings. I mean, massive, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it absolutely was. It was the banner year, the year of the saucer, and there was actually 1,501 reported sightings to Blue Book, Georgia, and out of those 1,501, there was 303 that were unidentified. Now, here's the interesting part, and this is what my book encompasses, is actually the summer of 52, June, July, August, and September, counted for 111 unknowns, and that's a staggering amount.
That is. It is huge. Now, of those 111 unknowns, were they all involving aircraft?
No. And
saucers? Okay.
But what's interesting is you see the incline. Like, there was 148 reports in June. In July, when the shoot-down order was admitted, and did we talk about the Ramey quote?
No, not yet.
Okay, General Ramey, actually, at the press conference at the Pentagon on Tuesday the 28th, he spoke about this, and there was 536 Project Blue Book reports that went in 1952 alone.
That's huge.
He said we've scrambled after them, what did he say, 300 times, Frank?
He said that
hundreds of times.
Yeah, hundreds of times. And then I discovered later on, Stanton, that Kehoe had been working with the Air Force. And December 1952 magazine article, Kehoe narrowed the number down to 300.
Why were we so hostile, Stan? Because we just didn't understand what these craft were?
I think it's more than that. I think we knew darn well that they represented advanced technology. I think we'd already lost some planes to them, whether inadvertently or intentionally, and because we were anxious to get our mitts on them. And remember, we were trigger-happy then. Remember the world situation. The Korean War was going on. We were using an enormous amount of resources in 1952 in Korea. And also, the airplanes were changing. Their armaments were changing. It's a point Frank makes in the book. Suddenly, you've got Mighty Mouse rockets instead of the machine guns, you know, from the airplanes.
We were getting more confident, weren't we?
We're getting more confident on the one hand and more concerned. It seemed clear to me from papers.
Hold on, Stan. Yeah. Hold on. We'll come right back with you and Frank in just a moment. And welcome back. We're with Frank Fascino and Stanton Friedman. And both of you, I'm going to keep we'll keep both your lines up, so it'll be like a roundtable discussion. So at any time, you can both jump into the discussion. But let's pick it up then. 1952, banner year. Stanton, what year? Wasn't that the year the White House got buzzed?
Yes, the summer, and Frank talks about it in the book, there were plenty of sightings over Washington, radar observations, airplanes scrambled and so forth. And I think, you know, when you go back a little, what was going on? One of the scariest memos I ever saw in my visits to a total of 20 archives was one from a National Security Council meeting, declassified, in the early 50s. And it said that the Soviets had made more progress in the development of nuclear weapons and means for delivering them in the past 18 months than had been expected for 5 years. There were many people in Washington who expected that Joe Stalin was going to attack as soon as he had enough airplanes and enough nuclear weapons. And so that would make you trigger happy. What if, and just a what-if question, what if the NSA, National Security Agency, and its predecessor eavesdropping agencies had picked up on the fact that the Soviets had shot down a UFO? Wouldn't we be concerned about their getting a big jump in technology? I mean, the first Soviet nuclear weapon was a carbon copy of our early one because they had spies. But after that, they were moving on their own. You know, as long as you're convinced that your enemy can get by only by copying you, you're guaranteed to be ahead, right? But what if he starts doing on his own? The world was a dangerous place, a very dangerous place. In 52, with, as I said, with us occupied in Korea, you know, Frank points out in the book that there were three pilots, American pilots, each of whom had more than 100 missions in Korea, where there were MiGs trying to shoot them down, you understand, came back to the United States, and they crashed. Does that make any sense?
No.
I mean, there aren't any MiGs back here as far as I know. So there was a desperate attempt to shore up our defenses, the Dew-Line, early warning radar system at the north and stuff. We were suddenly realizing we didn't have a good enough radar collection of systems protecting the United States. I mean, the Ground Observer Corps was set up. You're depending on people to tell you, hey, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming.
Now, were the Russians concerned about these saucers everywhere, Stan?
It appears that they were. I've heard some very interesting stories about they were trying to shoot down UFOs. And as a matter of fact, that there were some explosions of rockets on their launch pads because the aliens retaliated. You know, leave us alone, get off our back, apparently was the message. So there's a whole, that's part of that iceberg that I was talking about. What the heck was going on underneath all this stuff?
How nuts were we, though, to try to compete militarily with these craft?
Well, it was pretty silly, but if the hope was, look, we did have a crash saucer, at least from Roswell, two of them apparently, and people who were investigating those probably said, hey, we need more. We're starting to learn stuff here.
Yeah, we don't have all the pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah, and remember, consider how different technology was back then. I mean, young people today don't realize, you know, we were using slide rules back then, kids, not computers.
That's true.
Typewriters, not word processors. You know, you had a little piece on earlier about what you've lived through in your life.
Mm-hmm.
I was born earlier than you, George, I hate to admit it. And I remember some other events, you know, like Pearl Harbor, for example.
Yeah, which is tomorrow, our anniversary date.
Yes. Well, here it's already happened, you know.
That's right.
4 hours ahead of you. And I better tell the audience, no, Friedman isn't crazy. He's 4 hours ahead of the West Coast in Atlantic time zone in Fredericton, New Brunswick. Believe me, George, I've had people tell me you can't be Stan. It's only 3 time zones. I'm east of Maine, and the time zones changed.
You are way out. Well, these cases, let's have Frank tell us about one or two incredible cases where jets were either scrambled or were already up there. What did they report, Frank? What did they see?
In most cases in that era, George, there seems to have been not just the saucers in the summer of 52, but there was a lot of the cigar-shaped objects that were seen, and they were tremendous in size. And a lot of oval and round-type craft were sighted. And I didn't realize how many sightings until I started initially with the Flatwoods case. And all of those descriptions I just gave you were all seen over an 18-and-a-half-hour period throughout the United States. Flatwoods was not an isolated incident by any means. So then when I started looking towards the beginning of the summer of 52 and after the Flatwoods, it was like, holy cow, look at this. There's more than just saucers being seen. And the fighter pilots were seeing the same thing when they were up in the air. And what we were talking about before we went on a break with Stanton, and this is a very important point, the F-94C Starfire was unveiled in the first week of July of 1952, and the Starfires carried 24 rockets that were situated around the nose cone area, and these jets actually had an onboard computer, George, and they had automatic coupling between the firing system and the radar, which was set up behind the nose, and then these rockets could be launched or salvoed automatically by the computer when it would pick the precise moment to shoot at that UFO. The computer would take over and it would fire. Now, these rockets were pretty heavy duty. They were like, they weighed almost 20 pounds each. They had an 8-pound warhead and an effective range of 3.5 miles. And here's a good statistic for you. They traveled 2,500 feet per second, so these things were moving. And the point that I'm trying to get at is if you're up in the air and you have a squadron of jets or two or three squadrons and you're firing at UFOs, you could have hundreds of these things flying through the air. Now, within a certain distance, these things would be ballistic and they would start going crazy. So if the wind caught them, these picture 200 or 300 of these rockets in the air going after a target, the wind would pick them up and they would sweep and remove them. The rockets didn't even know where they were going. And this is what Stanton and I have talked about several times. This is going to be very hard if you're on the receiving end to try and duck and move away from these rockets.
Yeah, this is what they were using. Compare the rocket with a 50-caliber bullet, George, which does not weigh 8 pounds, obviously.
No.
Yeah, 18.5 pounds these rockets weighed. Now, George, the F-94C wasn't the only one that had these rockets. The F-86 Sabre Jet D model had them, and the F-7U3 Cutlass. The Navy had an optional belly pod packet that they could put on, and they also launched 24.
Did we ever shoot one down?
Well, that's what the book is about with the Flatwoods Monster incident. I tracked 4 damaged UFOs that flew across the United States within an 18-and-a-half-hour period with pieces exploding off of them, shrapnel, including the one that actually landed in Flatwoods was very damaged. And I pinpointed over 80 locations throughout the United States, 40 of them that involved 3 objects that came in and made distinct landings, puddle jumping, taken off again, and they were seen by thousands of witnesses that pieces exploding off. And matter of fact, since the last show that we did, Stanton Friedman actually got an email from a witness in Flatwoods, West Virginia, and this woman spoke about the damaged ship that came in and it had pieces falling off of it and it burnt the clothes on her clotheslines, the ashes and whatnot from the damaged ship.
All right.
So these shows are really working because after we do these shows, people are contacting Stanton and I and like, I remember this and this happened. So this is how the second book, Shoot Them Down, has all the new additions in here to do with the Flatwoods incident and a lot more information about the Shoot Them Down orders.
Well, if we damaged some of them, how many of our craft did they get? Our planes?
Well, tell them how many airplanes crashed, Frank, that we know from just the New York Times.
Okay, I went through the New York Times, George. I did what I call my independent case study.
And this is this period, right, that we're talking about?
What I did, George, is I went from 50 to 59, and I discovered between 51 and 56 that the New York Times had reported 204 stories with major fighter aircraft accidents, which mean that these fighter aircraft were destroyed or missing. And it's mind-boggling over the six-year period. And these 204 incidents, particular incidents, 229 aircraft were destroyed. And 192 were either destroyed or vanished over the United States.
And you like words like disintegrated and disappeared, which show up in some of these New York Times articles.
Did we ever get any tracking of, and I don't know if they recorded the pilots' radio transmissions or not, or if they typed them up, but did we ever see anything or hear anything like that, you two?
Well, I know of one case, a pilot, a Navy pilot who was in South Carolina. He was the only one on duty in the evening about 10 o'clock. The gong goes off, so to speak, and he gets scrambled, bogey at a certain direction and so forth. He gets vectored toward this unknown target that had been picked up by the radar, and he's up at 20,000 feet. He's looking around, where the heck did the target go? He looks down, it's way beneath him, and suddenly this thing climbs up at high speed, comes right toward him, shines a very bright light at him. He's scared, as you can imagine. He pulls the trigger on the guns. Nothing happens. The guns hadn't been loaded before he took off. Somebody goofed on the ground. Now, of course, all this time he's in touch with the ground, and he got interrogated when he came down for hours. And I've talked to him, and the guy's a lawyer. I mean, this is a very ultra-respectable guy, and we agreed that the only reason he's alive probably is that the guns hadn't been loaded. And so, you know, how many other cases are there? We don't know. This stuff is highly classified. And he commented that not only was he interrogated by military officers, Navy officers, but by some civilians, too. We don't know who they were. So the guys who get destroyed don't come back. He's one of the lucky ones. But there's a mountain of information that we're not getting, and I'm hoping that some of our listeners will take the attitude that retired General Thomas Jefferson Dubose did in our last conversation. He was in his late 80s. He said, I like what you're doing, Stan. If I remember anything else, I'll get in touch with you. What can they do to me now? Isn't that a great
thing? Yeah, it sure is. How many of the family members of these downed pilots were told the truth, though? What do you think they said to them?
I don't think any of them
were.
None?
No.
Well, let me give you an example. If you take the book, By Any Means Necessary, by William E. Burroughs, that's B-U-R-R-O-W-S, 2001, he talks about 166 military crewmen that were in reconnaissance planes that were destroyed when they were tickling, as the expression goes, North Korea, China, and Russia, starting in the late 40s. It wasn't until 2001 that there was a conference at which medals were given to the families, and they were told what had happened to their sons, brothers, whatever. 166 crewmen, not a word in public about what happened to those planes, lost at sea, unfortunate accident, you know. No input to the families that their kin were on a reconnaissance plane that got destroyed by the Russians. I mean, we knocked down a few Russian planes, too. We're not guiltly. There's enough guilt to go around here. But if we wouldn't tell those people what happened to their family, would we ever tell any family that, oh, yeah, your son died going after a UFO following orders?
And they shot him down. No, they're not going to say that.
No. So we'd like to hear from people who, you know, there were ground crews with these things. They would know about them, the radar crews. Who knows? I'd sure like, and maybe a few bailed out. People did jump out of airplanes back then. You remember those crash test dummies, George?
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was 47, Stan.
Well, it was a little later than that.
Yeah, sure was.
Actually, it was after 52.
All right, here's the big question. You know, David Jacobs would say that there's a hostile reason we're being visited.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, Stan, if you truly believe that these craft, 1952, 1960, 70, it doesn't matter when, really, are they really hostile to us?
Well, the thing is that we can't, I think that they're reacting.
I don't mean defensive, but I mean truly hostile. They're here to get us.
Well, you know, my feeling about that, George, if they wanted to get us, they could. You know, with the kind of technology that can get you here from someplace else, that can have a mothership that carries dozens of these little Earth excursion modules, as I call them, if they wanted to destroy us, the kind of energy we're talking about certainly could be used for, let's call it, evil purposes.
Sure.
You know.
I agree.
So, now, that doesn't mean they don't have long-term goals toward us, which we might not appreciate. Now, Alan Hynek once made a comment that, you know, the turkeys on a turkey farm in mid-November are congratulating themselves that they're being fed, they're kept warm, it's cold outside.
Life is good,
water,
right?
Yeah, life is great. Then Thanksgiving comes along and whoops!
Yeah.
That was a hasty conclusion.
Good point.
We are a hostile planet.
We're turkeys on a turkey farm, Stan.
Doesn't that sound great? I'm sorry. But, you know, it's a good example, though, how you got to be careful about judging motivation by certain activities. Women who have been lured by evil men know that you can't always believe what you're told.
Or vice versa.
Okay, I guess it happens.
It does happen.
But I don't think we're dealing with hostile, although, you know, stand back and look at the planet. As we speak, this year, the United States will spend $500 billion on things military. The rest of the world, roughly another $500 billion. And yet, it's not as if there aren't 30,000 children dying every day of preventable disease and starvation. You know, it's not as if we've taken care of the needs of the people on the planet. But we like playing games with guns, so to speak, big guns. And so an outsider looking at this planet has got to be wondering. And George, I presume that not only do they have high-performance aircraft, but they have good electronics. They can snoop as well as the NSA and so forth. And there was a headline on USA Today on Wednesday about major college football coaches' average salary over $1 million a year. Mm. Now, don't you think somebody might say, what's with these people?
No wonder tuition is up so high.
Well, I would say so. Some of these guys are making $3 million a year. Now, that tells you something loud and clear, doesn't it, about our society?
It sure does. Stan, stay with us. Frank, you as well. I want to get into some of the specifics of the Flatwoods Monster case again, because it is covered extensively in your book, Shoot Them Down. Websites, they're all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. In the final hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Stanton Friedman or Frank Fascino. But if any of you have been witnesses to the things we're talking about, or you have friends or family that might have been witnesses, they want you. We'll be back in a moment. I want to thank First Lieutenant Lance Brenner. He sent us one of his precious, I mean precious, platoon coins. He was in Iraq in 2006, and then he took with him 6 months of recorded coast-to-coast shows with him. And these coins, which you'll see on the coasttocoastam.com website there, it is just about incredible. The top of the coins is Operation Iraqi Freedom. There are only 105 of these in existence. And he just sent it as just thanks for listening to Coast to Coast. But the picture of it is up there with Tommy's hand holding up the coin. Back in a moment with Stanton Friedman and Frank Fascino on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Stan and Frank. Stan, let's talk, and Frank, let's bring the Flatwoods Monster case into this, because it is heavily profiled in the book Shoot Them Down. This occurred around what the time period again, Frank?
This was on September 12, 1952, at the end of the summer of the great Flap era. And the incident occurred about 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And what I did is when I first started investigating this case back in the early 90s, I had a lot of trouble working with the locals. And to make a long story short, George, what happened is these people in Braxton County, especially in the Flatwoods area, were ridiculed about what they had seen. They were made fools of.
They didn't trust anybody then, did they?
Right, because the press came in and they made a big joke out of it. A couple of the witnesses went on a national TV show the following week, and it was called We the People, broadcast in front of millions of people. They showed this ridiculous drawing of what was said to be a monster.
And this is in West Virginia now, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And the story just went crazy after that, and it just became a folklore type thing. Monsters wearing fish bowls on their head, wearing dresses with scary arms and claws that floated through the woods. People are like, yeah, this is kind of ridiculous. So they just stopped talking about it. Myself being an illustrator and trained for 4 years in art school and working in the industry, I found out by doing police-style renderings with the witnesses that this thing was not a monster wearing a cloth garment. It was actually a metallic structure of sorts. And the witnesses believed that this actually, the structure was like a spacesuit, and something was inside of it because it was being intelligently controlled by its maneuvers when it was sighted.
Okay.
Sounds
go ahead.
Almost like a hazmat kind of thing, working in a risky area so you're protected, whoever's inside these things. You know, we have the police use these things to go after bombs, you know, guys inside of protected environment, especially if there may be gases or nuclear or whatever outside. So something like that seems to have been going on here.
How would you rate this case, Stan?
It's a very intriguing case partly because of Frank's discussions with the military guys, Colonel Leavitt, whose involvement we really didn't know about until Frank got involved. I mean, you know, on any large scale, he had troops go in there secretly and pick up a lot of stuff that was on the ground and get samples and send them off to the government. Clearly, the government was very interested in this, but certainly not interested in going public. And there were investigators who talked to Mrs. May, the chief witness. There was an open side of the story, which had been investigated by a lot of people like Ivan Sanderson and who's the guy, Gray Barker,
and even Donald Keough got involved in this case too, George.
He's the one who put together NICAP at the time, right?
Right. He was a pioneer investigator of the era, but he didn't go into Flatwoods. He investigated Flatwoods on a governmental level. He was with his contacts in Washington. So he was finding out what was going on behind the scenes while Barker and Sanderson and a few other guys were actually went into the town. So it intrigued Donald Keough quite a bit.
Talk about the relationship here, Frank, then, between the flying saucer wars of 52 and Flatwoods. You believe that they're tied together.
Absolutely. What I discovered is that this was not an isolated case. Total now I'm about 17 years into investigating this whole summer of 1952 and this one particular night in Braxton County. I went in different directions. I did an omni search, George. I was the first one to look outside of Flatwoods in Braxton County, and I went north, south, east, and west in every direction around West Virginia, and I found out there were sightings that occurred over an 18 and a half hour period over 11 states. And surprisingly enough, I found probably about three quarters of my hardcore documentation was right in Project Blue Book itself. Nobody had ever taken the time to go through it and dissect what was going on that night. And there was 180 pages for September 12, 1952. And to give you an idea of what was going on, the Blue Book and the press around the United States for that night had reported mysterious lights. They called them sky objects, meteors, burning planes, flying saucers. You know, there was thousands of people over, around the country who saw these things. This wasn't just a bunch of people who saw a monster up on a hill that night.
Well, the Flatwoods Monster, what are we talking about? Was it a robot or was it the actual craft?
It was a smaller craft that came out of a big craft. The big craft was...
And that was the one that was damaged, right?
That was elliptical in shape. I tracked that coming across the United States, and it's documented in the Boston Globe the following day and the New York Times.
Where do you think that was shot or
off,
damaged?
Off the East Coast. I tracked three objects, George, came in over the eastern seaboard, and they split into a fan pattern. The first object went southwest and made a beeline and turned away shortly before reaching Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Nuclear weapons development site, uranium production.
All right, so this craft is wobbling its way over West Virginia, right?
Well, the first one, George, actually made a complete beeline towards Oak Ridge. It penetrated the no-fly zone by nearly 100 miles. Another object came in minutes later. That one headed northwest, and it got just within... It flew a couple hundred miles, and it actually just turned away short of Wright-Patterson. Now, if you look on a map, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, is directly over Oak Ridge, the way they're situated.
Directly north.
Directly north above. The third object came straight down the middle and actually buzzed Washington and came over at treetop level. Flew through the restricted zone. This was the Flatwoods Monster craft. It flew over Washington. Now, here's an interesting part, George, and I found this right in Blue Book itself. Within moments that this craft passed over Washington through the restricted zone and headed west towards West Virginia, when it got just on the outskirts of Washington, there was 12 craft that dropped out of the sky and surrounded the craft like guys on a football field.
Mm-hmm.
They'll help their blocker
trying
out.
Trying to protect it.
Yeah. And there are actually dozens of pages of witnesses who saw these objects dropping out of the sky around the Washington area. They formed a perimeter like a horseshoe shape, and they actually surrounded and backed up and followed this damaged craft. When it got safely outside of Washington, they went back up into the sky, and I tracked this object going 206 miles west of Washington. It hit Upper Braxton County, made a 45-degree angle turn, and flew about 8 miles south, flew over a school playground in the town of Flatwoods where a bunch of boys were playing out that night, and it turned again and went across and landed on the Bailey Fisher Farm. And
it's the highest
this is where
flat
Stan
area.
And I were.
It's the highest flat area in the neighborhood, and any pilot will tell you, George, if you got to hit the turf, you better find a place without trees, open area, and not run into a mountain.
No,
when I was on site at the 50th anniversary celebration, it was perfectly obvious why it would go there. That's rugged country out there, steep hills, gullies, that sort of thing. And a pilot would go crazy trying to find a place. But here was one flat place. Thank goodness, I'm sure somebody said.
Well, how long did this Flatwoods Monster stay or hover, and then what happened to it again?
When it landed, about 7:25.
PM
time, and it was on the ground till a little bit after 8 o'clock.
All right,
and it moved from the original place where it had come down to be much more harder to spot down the hill, and it's in that area where the monster was.
Was this like a lunar module lander, Stan? That
well,
kind
of
look.
I think of it that way. I think they had more control. The lunar module, you know, has limited control.
Sure.
Thrust and all that, but
had that kind of look though.
Well, same basic idea, yeah. I often use the term Earth excursion modules to describe flying saucers. We got motherships, the space carrier, if you will. And look, our nuclear-powered carriers carry, 75 little airplanes? They're much smaller, mm-hmm. They're not nuclear-powered, et cetera, et cetera. But as Frank pointed out, the motherships were being seen. They're still being seen. You know, we have great cases in the western part of the United States, over Alaska, et cetera, these huge monsters. Well, this is the Earth excursion module popping out of the mothership, doing its thing, and going back.
Well, what was its thing? What did it do?
Monitor, check, evaluate. Who knows
samples?
What they were looking for.
Animal what? Samples? You think it took things?
Well, I think they probably did. I think they may have been prospecting for minerals, too, for that matter. We do a lot of prospecting for the air with sensitive instrumentation. Mm. And I think they were also, look, standard, when you got military groups who are in competition with each other, you want to find out as much as possible about the other's capabilities. How fast, how high, how maneuverable, what kind of armaments. Rule number one is make sure you can get home. So you've got to know, we're always trying to find out what Soviet airplane capabilities are, right? Or Chinese, as the case may be, times are changing. So the overall question of why they're here is a different sort of question, but collateral to whatever their master plan is finding out about the capabilities, offensive, defensive, of the people who are here. Standard practice. Don't we do that all the time? We want our spies to report back.
Sure.
What do the new airplanes look like? What kind of radar do they use? What's their frequency? What's their pulse width? All this kind of stuff. That's just part of the picture. So whether they're hybridizing, abducting people for various stuff, whether they're teaching classes, who knows? That's one of the reasons we need an international effort to discuss what's going on here and what does it mean to our planet.
Did the policy, Frank or Stan, of shoot them down ever change, or do we still have that policy?
I think it changed at some point. I think somebody, as I mentioned earlier, the guy at the radar site in Montana in the early 50s, said take pictures instead of shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Out of self-interest, you say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't being very productive. We've lost all these airplanes. Maybe we better use instruments, not just cameras. People forget, many of our reconnaissance planes, if you will, carry a whole slew of instrumentation to monitor electromagnetic capabilities, radar, communications, all that sort of stuff. We have a lot of very sophisticated equipment out there. When the National Reconnaissance Office, NRO, puts up a spy satellite to monitor Soviet ships at sea, we put up 7 Poppy satellites between 1962 and 1971. They were monitoring the communications and defense and other signals coming from Soviet ships at sea. Those things run $500 million to $1 billion each. So we are trying to find out what's going on. These aren't to bomb the ships. They're to monitor, to do reconnaissance, to evaluate. This is part of the big picture.
And back in that time period, that's a pretty infant time period for us, wasn't it?
Yeah, we've learned a lot, spent a ton of money. It's funny, people ask me, don't you think the incredibly rapid advancement of our technology is due to back engineering the Roswell crash saucer? And I say, well, I think the biggest reason we've made such rapid progress is we spent so much money. It was just announced in the New York Times and U.S. News and World Report in early November that they were canceling, the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, was canceling a program that had been set up with Boeing to develop the next generation of spy satellites. They had already spent $18 billion, George.
That's a lot of money.
Oh, it sure is. And that's not with weapons now for weapons, but monitoring. So that's a big, big, big business. What was Ike worrying about, the military-industrial complex? Wow, especially when you can get away with it under black budget programs.
There was an investigator, Joe Nicol, right?
Well, I'll put that word investigator in quotes. Well, you know, he does have a PhD in English. He is a paid employee of the old SICKOP, Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal.
He looked at Flatwoods. What did he conclude?
Excuse me. Don't forget, he was a stage magician, Stanton.
Oh, yes. Yes, very active in stage magic. Well, he concluded he'd done an investigation. What was the monster was a 6-foot owl.
A 6-foot owl.
Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody knows about
Mothman. Maybe it was Mothman.
Well, you know, the funny thing is Joe went to Flatwoods, all right. He didn't talk to Mrs. May, the primary witness, and he didn't go to the actual location, so that he could see the obvious reason for landing at the top and what was going on coming down. And I don't call it that. That's why I say put investigators in investigation in quotes. But that's typical. He did similar things with regard to Roswell. You could see him on that National Geographic special. Research by proclamation. I mean, he had an early explanation for Roswell. It's equally silly. The story was made up by the public relations man. He didn't even know his name.
Amazing. Hey, I want to talk with you, Stan, and Frank, you can jump in the next half hour about Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill story. Shoot them down. Frank, where do you get this book?
You can get it off of my website, and it's being sold around the world, George, at a
it's a great story.
40 different locations. One thing I want to jump into real fast with the Flatwoods case, and this is kind of ties into the book and is very important. Stanton was at National Archives about 3 years ago, and he could not find the September cases for accidents, the government cases. He found all other different months.
Oh, yeah?
And the same month that the Flatwoods incident took place. And we also discovered, Stanton and I, that the Norton Air Force Base aircraft accident reports for September 12th, there were missing cases that were yanked out from that particular night. And one of the cases that was just recently released, which I talked about in my first book and I go into in depth, was the John Del Curto and Jones case, which two pilots were in an F-94 jet that disappeared off the face of the earth 45 minutes before the Flatwoods Monster incident. The documents have been disclosed. And it is the most ridiculous cover-up I have ever read in my 17 years of looking into it.
Can you imagine being a pilot coming up on a craft like that, and all of a sudden they either zap you or a huge craft just swallows you up and you're gone?
Well, they were on in a radar net, George. Three major Air Force bases, Tyndall, Moody, and MacDill.
Tracked them.
We're tracking them, and an independent air station in Florida. So they disappeared in a heartbeat right off of radar.
Jeez.
Right before the Flatwoods case, and the cases before and after the Jones and Del Curto case are missing.
All right, stay with us. We're going to be back with you, Frank, and Stanton will talk with you about Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience as well. Last hour, we'll take all your phone calls. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. Stan, let's take some time to talk about Captured, the work you did, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience. You know, every time I talk about this story, I pick up more and more new information on what is, to me, one of the most fascinating abduction cases I've ever heard, Stan.
Well, it is to me, too. And, of course, it's the first case that got serious attention. It's not the first abduction case, but John Fuller's book in 1966, The Interrupted Journey, written with the Dr. Benjamin Simon, the psychiatrist who was the hypnotist who hypnotized Betty and Barney separately, weekly, 6 months, extensive collection.
He was out of Boston, wasn't he?
Well, he was out of Boston. They were living in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. They drove down every Saturday, and that story, when it came out, there were two Look magazine articles, too, written by John as well. The story got international attention, and it set up the rest of the investigations all thereafter of UFO abductions because, A, Dr. Simon did such an incredible job of having them each independently relive this special experience of what happened on board the saucer. They certainly remembered seeing the saucer, stopping the car, as this went on the night of September 19th and 20th, 1961. But it took the hypnosis. It was not started until more than 2 years later, after Barney had developed an ulcer so bad he couldn't go to work anymore. Betty had had scary kind of dreams about being, I'll call it, abducted, picked up. The way the case was treated was so effective that it encouraged other people who may have had missing time experiences to try to find out what happened to them. And I found out, I was kind of surprised, Kathy and I were both signing books at the Mutual UFO Network Symposium in August in Denver, and so many people told both of us that this was the story that got them interested in UFOs.
Same with me when I was a kid.
You know, that's right. You were a little younger than I.
I was much younger than you.
but my point is that it got them intrigued, and also part of the intriguing, if you will, was the television program, The UFO Incident. It was on NBC. It was done by Universal Studios, starred James Earl Jones. This is 1975. And James played Barney. And, you know, today we all make a big deal about interracial marriages and stuff like that. But in 1961, that was a big deal. There weren't too many. There were states where it was illegal to have mixed couples. James Earl Jones being such a powerful actor. I was a consultant on that, and I still think it's really funny that Universal heard about me from the Air Force.
How'd that happen?
Well, you know, Project Blue Book had been closed in 69. Now, the Air Force still had instructions to pilots what they should do if they see UFOs and pilot manuals.
Yeah, shoot them down, right?
Well, yeah, but also, if you just see one, make a report, a service report, CIRVIS, Communication Instructions for Reporting Vital Intelligence Sightings. That's a mouthful, but the 2004 pilot manuals for our advanced aircraft tell Air Force pilots what to do, make such a report, observe this, that, and the other thing. I mention that only because I say Blue Book was closed in 69. But we are already aware from General Carol Bolander that instructions that were given about, closing Project Blue Book, but reports of UFOs which could affect national security are not part of the Blue Book system, is what General Bolander said in 1969. The Air Force was told if people contact them, refer them to a scientist in the area, and I was living in Southern California, and so I get a call from Universal Studios, and it was only later that I found out that they'd gotten my information. I'd done a lot of radio shows and all that sort of thing from the Air Force, but the story had just a lot of action from people. The book was published in several languages. It was a bestseller, and I got involved fairly early on. I read the book. I read the Look magazine articles. Everything was in my gray basket, maybe. And then I had a chance to meet Betty and Barney in November 1968 in Pittsburgh. And a sort of strange way, I got a call from Westinghouse Broadcasting, and I'd done a lot of shows with them. KDKA Pittsburgh, George, one of the early big stations, you know.
Yeah.
Probably the first big radio station. Anyway, I had done a lot of shows with them. They let me know that they were bringing Betty and Barney into town and where they would be staying. Now, as you know, that's very unusual to give out that information. They trusted me. I had dinner with Betty and Barney. I was very favorably impressed. And it turns out the people at the station were, too. I talked to them later. They see a lot of people coming and going, and they tend to be, well, let's face it, cynical people.
Sure.
Then I got a call from Coral Lorenzen, one of the founders of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, asking if I would be willing to contact a woman named Marjorie Fish, who was working on the star map that's in the book.
Which makes this story even more incredible.
Well, yeah, it, to me, it was the icing on the cake. Meeting the people convinced me that they were obviously sensible, intelligent, not making crazy claims, et cetera, et cetera. But the star map work, which was done by Marjorie, who visited Betty first, she was skeptical because they described sort of humanoid-like beings. In other words, these weren't science fiction monsters, no three-legged or whatever, anything like that. But Marjorie had studied biology, a brilliant woman, member of Mensa, school teacher, but very bright. When she visited Betty, she got convinced that, hey, maybe there was something to this, despite the humanoid appearance of the aliens. And she did something quite extraordinary. She built 26 different three-dimensional models of our local galactic neighborhood to see if she could find a 3D pattern that would match the two-dimensional one that Betty had drawn under a post-hypnotic suggestion from Dr. Simon, if she could remember it accurately. I mean, she's asking the leader of this group. She had guts, Betty did. Where are you from? I know you're not from around here. And he shows her this, I'll call it a hologram, which is probably what it was, something like that. It was a bunch of stars, points of light, connected with different kinds of lines. And she's looking up at it, and she asks, well, where are you on the map? And the alien says, well, do you know where you are? No, I don't know anything about astronomy. How can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at? End of discussion. You can imagine what was going through Dr. Simon's head as he's listening to this.
He believed the story, didn't he?
Well, Dr. Simon was in a very peculiar position. It didn't take him long to realize that Betty and Barney weren't liars. They weren't making up the story. That he certainly had no doubt that they had seen a UFO, what led up to the story, and before the missing time occurred. He also recognized that it took a lot of effort on his part. He had a great amount of experience dealing with shell shock war veterans. Today we'd say suffering from post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, that's true. He was an expert in that.
Yeah, I've seen the Army actually made a movie of him working with some of these shell shock war veterans. He ran a hospital with 3,000 beds. You know, we hear about guys coming back from Iraq with mental difficulties, you know. Well, World War II provided more than its share of such people. So Simon was very good at having people relive traumatic experiences and get them out of their system, so to speak, so they could get back to living again. But he didn't know whether there were flying saucers or not, and he tried to push them. And this is one of the things that comes out in the book. Kathleen Martin, who's Betty's niece and has all the tapes that were made, transcribed them all. Now, John Fuller's book doesn't have stuff from all the tapes. And it was perfectly clear, and you can read about it in the book, that Dr. Simon was trying to push Barney in the position of, well, it was just you were responding to Betty's dreams. It's a pretty neat trick when you think about it. But and so you hear about the Joe Nichols of the world complaining that the hypnotists are just trying to get people to say what the hypnotists want them to say. He doesn't tell you about Dr. Simon trying to get the people to say that it wasn't a flying saucer rather than that it was. And so he left it open, so to speak, although he preferred to believe that it was this picking up on the dream. Kathy has clearly shown that that wasn't the case at all. Whenever there was a situation, for example, when they're in the car just before they were taken on board, in the dreams, Betty has 9 to 11 people are surrounding the vehicle. In reality, she and Barney separately described three people coming up to him on this side of the car, driver's side, three people coming up to her on the other side, and dragging him on board. So it was working with Marjorie Fish. I visited her. I talked to her. In my movie, UFOs Are Real, there's a statement from Dr. George Mitchell, the astronomer at Ohio State University. She needed access to lists of distances to stars and angles, position data. And that was hard to come by back then, and Mitchell's people helped out. And he and his students did an evaluation. They used the model as a teaching tool. And they complimented her on how accurate she was, how carefully done, and so forth.
Did anybody try to refute her? And could they? Okay.
Well, yeah, they did.
They tried to.
Well, I wrote the first article. It was in Saga magazine, like 1973. Some people may remember Saga. It was out there for several years. And then I convinced Terrence Dickinson, the editor of Astronomy magazine, which is still around. He's not the editor anymore, but to do an article about her. And he talked to her, talked to Dr. Mitchell, talked to a bunch of other people. The article got more response than anything they'd ever published. And some of it was negative. My University of Chicago classmate, Carl Sagan, tried to poo-poo the story. They published 11 letters over the next year, and then they put out a 32-page full-color booklet with the whole story. And I talked to Terry less than a year ago, and we're both impressed by how well the work has stood up. And initially, I was depressed by the fact that everybody who was attacking her work, including Carl, was misrepresenting what she did. You will get people telling you that she only used the sun-like stars in the neighborhood, so of course that's why all the stars in the pattern are sun-like stars. Well, I've got a slide, which I use in my lectures, that shows 256 stars in it. Just local neighborhood now, when there are only 46 of them that are sun-like. So she used all the stars. And her work really impressed me because it turns out that all the stars connected by lines are indeed sun-like, and that all the sun-like stars in that volume of space, think of a cube 80 light years on a side, so to speak. This is local neighborhood, George. We're not talking about other galaxies or across our galaxy, just down the street, around the corner, that sort of thing. And it turns out that the base stars, they're the kicker in this whole thing. Nobody, you won't find any publication saying that the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our neighborhood is Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody, you won't find that anywhere. And so I have checked with rather observatories, and they agree that's a great place to expect there to be intelligent beings. No, we haven't picked up any signals from them. Not surprising. I don't expect advanced civilizations are sending radio signals that we can pick up to us. They're using something better. Gee, I shouldn't say that on a radio program, should I, George?
Well, yeah, but, you know, Stan, this case... And they describe these occupants much like Roswell. It was just too, you know, I don't believe in coincidence. It was too coincidental. So without coincidence existing, you come down to logic. And logic tells you they may have seen the same creatures. It was real.
Yeah, it was real. And now, you understand, some people are bothered very much and will insist aliens cannot look anything like us, and therefore this story is fraudulent. Like they have a catalog of all the beings out there, and they know who's traveling here this month, which is nonsense. Hey, whether you like it or not, aliens coming here on board flying saucers seem to be humanoid,
yes,
generally speaking.
And that could be because we are they.
We could have a common origin. We could be somebody's colony, penal colony,
absolutely,
I think, judging by the way we act.
See, that's logical, too.
Yeah, so the case, the fact that it pinpoints, and think about how different your viewpoint would be about life in the universe if you were on a planet around one of these two stars. They're only 39 light years from here. It's just down the street, but they're only an eighth of a light year apart, which means that the other star is visible from a planet around the other one all day long.
And they have to have had a different kind of propulsion system.
Well, yeah, but they also happen to be a billion years older than the sun.
That's right.
A cool billion years. And
hey, look what happened. What do you think 100 years from now will look like on this planet?
That's right. And 500 years, forget about it. We have no way to judge.
No.
1,000, you know, look back at 1,000. So that's one of the things. Once I worked with Marjorie and introduced her to Dr. J. Allen Hynek and so forth, was there in Akron, Ohio, when she gave a paper at the Mutual UFO Network Symposium back then and helped explain it. And it was the star map work that said, here's information nobody knew, couldn't have been gotten the results when the event happened because we didn't have the data on several of the stars. People don't understand sometimes that astronomers aren't going anywhere. And back then it was hard to measure distances to nearby stars very accurately. And so without accurate distance data, you can't build a three-dimensional model, little beads hung on nylon fish line, that sort of thing. Now, in the last 5 years, the Hipparcos satellite, operated by the European Space Agency, made over, well, millions of measurements of distances from space, not from down here. And so we have much, much more accurate data. And now you can build the models because we've got good data. And so there's a point here. If any civilization is a little bit ahead of us, we expect within 20 years to have satellites in space that will enable us to observe planets around all the stars in the local neighborhood if they're there, easily.
And we know they're there.
Well, we know the stars are there. We've already found 240-some exoplanets, planets around other stars. Now, that's tough on the ego. Hey, you mean ours isn't the only planet around a star? Oh, gee. We thought we were at the top of the heap.
Not so. There's many of us out there.
Yeah, so the fact that we will be able to do that in 20 years, obviously somebody with a little head start would know that we have a planet here on which there is biological activity. They'd have known this a million years ago. You see, my vision of the neighborhood is that there are libraries which list all the sun-like stars, and this one has two planets where there is life. This one has three. This is an old civilization. This is a young civilization. You know, that's the kind of data you want to know.
I think you're right. Stay with us. Stan Friedman with us. Frank Ficino's with us. And now we're going to take your phone calls. Those of you who might be witnesses to some of these events, shoot them down, the Flying Saucer Air Wars of 1952, or maybe your father, maybe your mother told you about them. You might want to share those stories with us. And just general UFO questions as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take your calls. Hey, Frank, let me ask you, on the back of your book, you've got an incredible picture of a 1954 photograph. Can you kind of paint us a picture and describe it for people who aren't looking at it?
Yes. It's a 1954 photograph of a pair of F-94C Starfire jets that carried the rockets from Griffiths Air Force Base. And in the upper right-hand portion of the picture, there's three UFOs with motion lines connecting them. And this picture was taken of a series of shots by a professional photographer from a New York paper. He started on the ground, he went up into the air, and he took these actual pictures there. Now, what's interesting about this particular pair of jets is there was a famous case that took place shortly after this photograph was taken, and it was the famous Walesville, New York incident, where an F-94C Starfire from this state, the same Griffiths Air Force Base, actually the Starfire went out to intercept the UFO, and it crashed into a town.
Okay, to
so
the
there
full.
Was a lot of UFO activity where in that section of New York where Griffiths Air Force Base jets were sent out on intercepts.
All right, thank you, Frank. Let's take some calls. Let's see what we've got here. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, how y'all doing?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
I used to live in McMinnville, Oregon, about around about 95, and I was looking up at the moon one night, and I noticed this big, bright star, brightest star I've ever seen, about the 7 o'clock position below the moon. And just, you know, instantly, I just got this feeling that something wasn't right about it. I watched this thing for about two and a half, maybe 3 months. I was looking up at it one night, and it just faded out into nothing. Just disappeared, just like the chandeliers in your dining room. It's got that little knob on the wall where you can adjust the brightness of the
yep,
light.
Yep.
And it, you know, I watched it, and about a minute later, it brightened back up to the brightest light in the star again. And I've seen it do this several more times over the next couple, you know, several weeks. And one night I looked up there, and there was another star just like it, about the 1 o'clock position up above the moon. Well, I watched this thing for a couple months, and I started seeing it do the same thing. Only when it faded out into nothing, there'd be a little blinking light kind of come up behind it and disappear into it, and then it would brighten back up again. Well, one weekend I was in Salem, probably about 2:30 in the morning. I was out in the valley just north of Salem, and I come around this corner and looked up in the sky, and there's this, like, egg-shaped object floating across the valley. It's probably about maybe 200-300 feet off the ground. And I stopped my car. I got out. I looked at it. My girlfriend was with me. She's seen it, too, so I know it wasn't hallucinating. And this thing worked its way up, and it didn't turn like an airplane. It kind of zigzagged a little bit and went up to the 1 o'clock position on the moon that I'd been watching for a couple of months. Well, I watched the thing for the next couple of hours. Well, it finally left where it was next to the moon and went over towards Portland. And I watched it come down and then start going parallel with the horizon. And all of a sudden, it started letting out these little blinking lights. The first 12 lights that come out, they were kind of like a whitish, bluish color. And they would come down at about a 45-degree angle, headed towards the east. And then just up above the ground, they would curve back down towards the west and disappear into the horizon.
Well, let me get your take on this, Stan, because I don't want the, you know, complete details of a sighting here. But what are people seeing when they describe things like that?
I really don't know. They may be seeing astronomical phenomena. You know, I was going to say variable star, but that doesn't fit when you look at the whole business. You need a lot more detail, and reports like that are very frustrating to me because there's not much you can do with them. If you got exact time, if you got reenact the case with the witness so that you can see angles, for example. Now, people say something was huge. Well, that means different things to different people. For as one problem. You know, you got to pin them down. I've had people say, it was huge, and then, well, how big was it compared to the moon? Oh, much smaller than the moon, apparent size. Well, you know, which way is it? You can cover the moon with an aspirin tablet at arm's length. Try it sometime for those who think, oh, come on. Now, at arm's length, now you can't hold it up next to your eyes.
First-time caller line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Bob calling from Minnesota. Good morning.
Hi, Bob.
I worked several years ago in the state of Maine, and one of my coworkers was a neighbor of Benny and Barney Hills in New Hampshire. And we would talk, and he would not go into great detail, but because of his closeness to them, he was a definite believer in them and in UFOs and extraterrestrials. And I guess it was part of through some of the things that I've experienced and my conversations with him, he was totally convinced as their neighbor that they were totally on the up and up and made us all believers.
Well, this one's for you, Stanton, back and forth.
Well, yeah, I think it's important to realize that Betty was a social worker, a supervisor in the welfare department, state of New Hampshire. Barney did work for the post office, but he also was very active in civil rights back then, was on the governor's civil rights commission in New Hampshire. They both were active in the church. These were very respectable people, and it was one of the reasons they didn't want any publicity. The reporter calls him from the local paper. Somebody had given him a clandestine tape, if you will, of a quiet private lecture they had given, and they thought they'd lose their jobs if they got any publicity, but they went to a lawyer. There was no way you could stop the reporter from writing what he was going to write. But these were very, very respectable people. Kathy heard about the sighting, you know, the day after it happened. Betty called her sister, Kathleen's mother. And so I'm not surprised at what the caller is saying, because everybody who knew them way back when will tell you, these are not people who make up stories. These are solid citizens.
Let's go to our next East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes, sir. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Cleveland.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was when I was a boy. I remember my mom took me up to upstate New York, and we would always talk about. She would always talk about the funny stars that's in the sky, and she would say behind the mountains there was a winery, like a winery grove or something.
Yeah.
And found out that it was actually an alien. I guess a launch pad or something. They would come down with the ships and talk to me when I was a little boy, and I was always intrigued about that. And I always wanted to look into a UFO investigating, and now that, you know, Stan Freeman talking about the UFOs, they exist, and maybe with somebody they'll land and talk to us.
I'd like one to talk to me, but
I would
probably
too.
Too cold today. But
did you see these creatures?
Yeah, they said I used to see them when I was little, and I used to play with them when I was a little boy, and now I wish they can land and see me now. Maybe they can pick me up, but I guess I'm too heavy.
All right.
Well, you know, well, I should mention Bud Hopkins, who's one of our foremost abduction researchers.
Yes, he is.
Bud has a number of cases where little kids were picked up. I remember one, the family found the child at the door in the middle of the night, and the door was locked, and the child had been inside. Now, how'd the child get outside and not be able to get back in? And Bud has a bunch of pictures drawn of various and sundry things, Santa Claus, and, you know, symbolic stuff that kids might be interested in. And it's amazing. He's got people who point at their little playmates, and that's your typical alien face.
Almost like Bigfoot playing with kids. Same kind of thing. Wildcard line, you're up with us. Hello there.
Hi, my name's Jack. I'm calling from Bradenton, Florida.
Hi, Jack. Thanks.
Hey, real quick, it's just an honor to speak with all of you. I'm just a huge fan. And about 2 months ago, I emailed Mr. Friedman just a quick paragraph about a sighting my mom had back in the 70s. And he emailed me back, like, right away. And I just want to say thank you, because to me that was like a little kid meeting, you know, their sports idol or something like that. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask the quick question. I guess to Mr. Friedman, what do you believe the intentions are of the people visiting the planet, or is there multiple different beings who all have different intentions? I was just curious as to that.
Well, it appears that they're here for a number of reasons. I mean, if the bus is going this way, might as well send all the grad students. But and on my website at www.stantonfriedman.com, I have the UFO why questions is one paper. And one of the questions, of course, is why are they coming here? And I give about 20 reasons. You know, why did people go west in the United States back in 1849? There's gold in them thar hills, you know, and up to Alaska and to Australia. The bottom line for me is that I assume that every advanced civilization is concerned about its own survival and security. That seems to be everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
That being the case, you have to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs when they show signs of being able to bother you.
Yes.
And at the end of World War II, there were three signs that soon these idiot earthlings, this primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare, I don't know a better way to describe
it. And they've stumbled now into the nuclear age.
Well, yeah, we got rockets, V-1, V-2, we've got atomic bombs, we got fancy electronics, radar. These guys are going to be out bothering us within 100 years. And any sensible civilization would say, hey, wait a minute, do we want these guys out here? Heck no. So I think they're here to quarantine us, if I can put it that way. Make sure we don't get out there until we grow up. Now, whether we will grow up or not, I don't know. That's the challenge of our time, to stop killing and start feeding. But I think they're concerned about us. Now, it may be that they've been stealing resources, those nodules at the bottom of the ocean, you know, grabbing an asteroid or two to strip them of the metal and so forth. We don't know. But I think the notion that we're at the top of the heap, we're the advanced civilization, blah, 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 is baloney. I think we're at the bottom of the heap, that the space is crawling with other civilizations. The reason I say that is we haven't been around that long. I mean, the whole planet's only been here 4.5 billion years, and there's stars out there that are
13 billion years old.
You know, I keep saying, Stan, why come and visit us? What are they doing? You know, if they're mining, we really don't have signs of it today. You know, Zechariah Sitchin would say he did. But I think we've been seeded. I think they're watching us because they help make us.
A competition. Who did the best job of planting a colony on Earth? Hey, all of you guys goofed.
Yeah. Drastically, too. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
Hi, George. This is Jeff in Albion, California.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, you bet. And I was a fire spotter in 1992 in Northern California. I used to read the logs after my duty shift was over, and there was a fascinating entry that I found in 1947. This gentleman, his name happened to be Pinkerton. And he had made hundreds of fire log entries, but this one was amazing to me. He saw a, quote, flying saucer flying just below the level of the fire tower. And to make this entry when his job with the government was to spot fires and not flying objects was quite amazing that he put that into this book. And I also happen to be stationed at Norton Air Force Base when I was in the Air Force. Stanton, I wanted to ask you, you used to have a book available through a P.O. box. I wonder if that book is still available, and also I'd like to contact you that way rather than by computer because the NSA, et cetera, the government interference, and I certainly would hate for the record to be destroyed if somebody found out before I was
okay.
able to get you a copy of it. Is that possible to do?
I'm not sure which book. Crash at Corona was my first book, The Definitive Study of the Roswell Incident. The second one was Top Secret Magic. And, yes, if you got your pen, I have Post Office Box 958.
958?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Houlton, Houlton, Maine, M-E, 04730-0958. And if you go to the website, www.stantonfriedman.com, it tells you how you can order all this stuff. You can use PayPal, too, but if you want to stay away from electronics, you can download an order blank, send a check. You know, it's amazing, George, how honest people are who are interested in UFOs.
I know.
I don't have checks bounce. That's not a challenge to anybody out there.
Now that you brought that up.
Yeah, but, yeah, all of my books are available. Captured is available that way, and incidentally, I know, it's cheaper on Amazon. They got better buying power than I have. But if you get it from me, you get both signatures, both authors' signatures. That's all on the website. Or you can send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll send you a free list of books and stuff.
All right, let's get to Wildcard Line. You're up with us. Good morning.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Take it away.
My father always told me a story. In 1963, he was stationed at Griffith Air Force Base, and he was flown down to New Jersey. He was a bomb disposal and had to, render safe a nuclear missile that burned up.
God, we got a scratchy line on you. Tom, take care of Wild Line 2, and we'll call you back and see if we can get a better line. Sounds like you've got a great story. I don't want to miss that at all. Stan and Frank, do you still get whistleblowers? Do they contact you, too?
Yes, quite a bit, George. As a matter of fact, Stanton and I were in West Virginia this past September for the 55th anniversary of the Flatwoods Monster. We had a big event up there in Charleston, and I spoke to quite a few people who came forward in reference to the Flatwoods Monster case. And after they had read the book, they would contact me after they read the first book, the second book. And it's quite amazing how these public appearances, how people will come forward and tell us stuff, or they will meet us, talk to us, and then email us.
So I also get phone calls. My phone number is in my books, and people seem to be surprised that I would do that and put my phone number in and that I would answer my own phone. I think they think I got a big organization. I'm a one-man organization. And, people, I just got an email from somebody who described jets chasing a UFO in 1957 near Minneapolis, September 57, a few weeks before Sputnik. And we're looking for my, I'll give out my email address, FS for flying saucer, of course, PHYS for physicist, at rogers.com, rogers.com. So I don't hide. I've never had an unlisted number.
You're out there. Are you still traveling a lot, Stan?
Well, I'm working on the book for these couple of months, Flying Saucers and Science.
So you try to lay low on that when you do
that?
Yeah,
at the moment. But then once the book is finished, we'll be out traveling. I'll be in Aztec, New Mexico for their annual conference, another crash saucer case. That's March the 28th, 29th, and 30th.
Okay, well, stay with us, Stanton Friedman. Frank, we're going to be back in a moment. We're going to take final phone calls. We've reconnected with Paul, whose line was a little scratchy, so we'll get his story, too, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Let's take Paul first of all. Paul, I know you've been on hold for a while. Let's see how the connection is.
Oh, that sounds better.
There he is. Okay, go ahead.
So basically, back in 1963, my father was stationed in Griffiths Air Force Base. He was a bomb disposal person. And he was called down, him and his commanding officer were called down to New Jersey. A nuclear missile had burned up on a launch pad, and he was there to, you know, render it safe, take it apart or whatever.
Right.
He said once he got down there, they saw these, you know, pod prints on the ground with hieroglyphic-type writings on them. And, you know, he put his Geiger counter against it, and they pegged out on beta radiation and proceeded. You know, that was a whole story in itself, taking apart a nuclear missile. That was really the point of the story, which was, you know, fascinating to me. But then years later, he had heard that apparently he was describing that incident to someone, and they said, well, yeah, there's a story where, you know, a UFO was flying over. They tried to shoot it down, and they, you know, put some heat beam on it and burned it up on the pad, and that was the incident. So I was wondering if you guys ever heard of any incident like that.
All right, Stan, Frank?
No, that's a first for me, George.
Well, certainly I've heard of, how shall I put this, our systems being decommissioned, put out of action. As a matter of fact, at the big press conference in Washington, D.C. on November 12th, the Iranian jet case, it was clear that the UFO was able to cause a malfunction of all the systems on the airplane. This would be in keeping the airplane just trying to go after it, fire its missiles, and whoops, now nothing works. Came back on when they turned away. So this is consistent with that picture of somebody saying, hey, you idiots, get off my back, if I can rephrase the reality. So that doesn't surprise me. I haven't had any direct accounts of exactly like that. But makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, you're not only worried about the airplanes chasing you, but how about the ground control missiles that are going after you? Protect yourself. That's the first rule of an aviator, isn't it?
And I do know the whole time I was growing up, I guess every few years, or, you know, a guy would come out, you know, some federal person, and, you know, ask him if he ever talked about it. Well, I guess he did talk about it to me, but, you know, they did actually check up on my father to, you know, he since passed away. But
that's a great story, but it's well worth calling you back for.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more. My website has had a reach me. It has a phone number on it, too, for that matter. Don't call me in the middle of the night.
All right, we'll do that. StantonFriedman.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with Stan and Frank. Hi there. Sounds like a talk show duo.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Am I on?
I think so, yes.
My name is Joe Aguirre.
Okay, Joe.
And I'm in Sun Valley, Nevada.
Okay.
And I knew a general that flew with the F-15, the one of the guys that beat the speed limits and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was a chase pilot. And then he went from there to being working for Area 51 when they had nuclear bombs blow off. They had a big cloud of nuclear stuff going towards Las Vegas, and they sent them up to disrupt the nuclear clouds, you know, go counterclockwise to get it away from the Las Vegas, and they saw a UFO, and it really shook him up, and they went after it, and his plane started acting erratic, and they told him that, you know, they shoot at it and stuff like that. Before they got able to shoot at it, he had to bail out because his plane started falling apart.
Gee.
And he ended up with radiation burns on his legs and stuff. And then after a while, they decommissioned him. He lost his pension. He lost everything. And
what did he do wrong for them to do that to him?
I don't know. I guess what he saw, because at the end of his life, because they had to amputate his leg because it was so badly...
Cancerous?
Cancerous, burns, or problem with the spaceship or whatever.
Did he ever explain what he saw up there?
Well, he explained some to me when he was passing away, because I got to know him quite a bit because of... I got to know him because he was a radio operator or whatever in the service and stuff, and I wanted to learn. And he, end of his life, he couldn't work no more, so I helped out at his shop and stuff, and then I went to visit him in the hospital, and he finally broke down and started telling me these stories, and even about the F-15 pilot that supposedly broke his rib on the horse accident. It wasn't a horse accident. It was something else.
So did he tell you what he saw?
Yeah, he saw, you know, like a spaceship and lights and stuff, and it got hit with a laser light or something like that, and then his plane just...
And that was a long time ago. How old are you now?
I will be 53 tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Well, you're still a young puppy.
Yeah, but he passed away in about 90s, and I'm getting, I'm a young puppy, but I'm getting old, but I wanted to tell his story before.
Well, I'm glad you did. Stan, that's one of those stories.
Stuff like that, but I don't want to really say it over the radio.
Okay, would you give it to Stan and Frank later?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll
sure. If they want to, put me on hold, and I'll tell them,
Okay, I'll tell you what. We'll get your phone number, Tom, on our first-time caller line, and we'll get it to Stan and Frank. That's a story you'd probably like to get more info on,
yeah,
Stan, huh?
Absolutely.
Certainly.
Like that? Okay, let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening, George, and Stan and Frank. It's
Hi.
An honor to talk with you. This is Mike calling in Georgia. I wanted to get your comments on one of the most remarkable videos I've seen of a UFO. That's that one with the shuttle mission that shows the Earth, curvature of the Earth, and it looks like a white ball coming up to the Earth, and it looks like an explosion or a missile or something comes up from the Earth, and the thing gets out of the way at the last.
It's that classic shuttle piece of tape, Stan. You've seen it. Looks like a rocket's been shot out there.
Yeah, and I don't know what that is. I've got it in my gray basket, because certainly we've tested a lot of systems that the public hasn't heard about. Black budgets are multi billion dollars a year to develop far out stuff, and part of SDI maybe to be used against aliens. Who knows? So I don't know what to make of that. We don't have enough data to really establish how far away that thing is. You know, the right angle turn and all that sort of stuff. So these are fascinating. We need more courses being taught at the college level. We need major research programs going on, and there may be on the inside, but we sure don't hear about them on the outside.
What do you think of deathbed confessions, Stan, when it comes to these cases?
Well, they're no better than any verification that you can get. I'd like more of them, because you want to be able to establish that the person is who he says he is and was where he says he was, military records, that sort of thing. There are a lot of records out there, but the government isn't giving them out. So I think they're good. What has a guy got to gain? As General Dubose told me, what can I lose now? what's he got to gain either by making up a story? There's no satisfaction out of that. How can you say gotcha when you're dead, you know?
Good point. West of the Rockies, take it away. Hi.
Hello there.
Yeah.
Hi. I just had a question for the guys. I've seen UFOs ever since I was a kid, but nothing as close as since I've moved to Salem. And there is an Air Force base close by, and I'm not real familiar with it because I've only lived here like a year.
Oregon.
Yeah, Salem, okay. Oregon. And you had mentioned McMinnville, so. But I went from seeing, like, way up there, it looked like little pin lights. And I heard somebody refer to it as, like, the water bug motion. I prefer the Etch-a-Sketch, how it kind of just, they just skip around.
The erratic movements.
Right. And then we have, like, you know, you see 4 and then 8 and then 12. And then one night I went out and saw 5 right where I could see the detail of the metallic. There were 3 to the east, or no, 3 to the west. 2 on the ones on the side of it were more cylindrical.
Did you see any occupants there?
No, wasn't that close.
Do we get any more of those reports, Dan? Occupants.
Occupant reports?
Yeah.
Sure.
Still keep coming in, huh?
You know, there's a heck of a lot going on. MUFON gets well over 200 reports a month of UFOs. And abduction researchers, I get a couple email a week of people who want help with an abduction case, you know, and I try to refer them to somebody who might be able to help them use hypnosis or a support group or stuff like that. But there's plenty going on. You may not know it from the major media, but there's a lot going on out there, George.
First time caller line. Take it away. You're on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, hi, George. My name is Bruce. Great show.
Hey, thanks, Bruce.
I grew up in Walesville, New York, and my father told us about that plane crash that the UFO shot down. He used to live about a quarter mile away, and he said he lived on a farm, and he told us how he'd seen the guys jump out with the parachutes and land.
Did he say anything about the UFO case?
No, but I read about it in the books in our high school. It wasn't in the books, but he did say that there was a UFO they were chasing.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, and that... He built a house three houses down from where that crash site was. He says there were missiles and everything on that airplane.
Well, Stan, how about that?
Well, it's a famous case. And,
yeah, we used to live. We lived 10 miles from Griffiths Air Force Base, too. Unfortunately, that base has closed down.
Yeah, a lot of the bases, the one in Portsmouth that Betty and Barney Hill reported to, is closed. Pease Air Force Base is closed.
Frank, what happened to the UFO? Did it get away?
Obviously so. But what's interesting about that case is that when there's a radar operator in those jets as well, George, those F-94s, and the cockpit had heated up to extreme high levels, but there was no fire ever reported in the accident reports. So the heat, the source came from somewheres.
You know, it's just amazing. They're chasing something, unidentified. Something happens to their plane. They've got to jump out. I mean, how real can you get?
Yeah, there's a lot of cases like that.
A car on the ground.
In the 1950s that happened, George, there's dozens of them where planes were just hitting into towns and cities all over the United States.
Wild card line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Anita. I was calling from Dayton.
Go ahead, Anita.
Hi, I was wondering if any of you had ever heard of anything like this. I was leaving work one night. I live in Dayton, Ohio. I was working about maybe a mile away from Wright Pat. And there were these three, I don't know how to describe them. They were like ball lights. They were orange. And they were in a triangle formation, kind of like lights that would be on the bottom of an airplane, but there was no airplane.
Would you think it was one big craft or three separate...
They moved in a perfect triangle formation.
Yeah,
they appeared
it might have
be
been
separate.
The big one.
They were completely silent. They were right over my head.
We've heard this before, Stan Friedman, haven't we?
Oh, yes. Yeah, triangles are the end thing on the UFO scene.
They really are, and I'm beginning to think they're ours.
Well, there are some people who think that, and I don't know. Time will tell, but the government won't.
No. No. You know, National Press Club, November 12th, the huge news conference there, several pilots telling about their close encounters, probably picked up the best publicity of a news conference directly related to UFO cases than we've had in a long time.
Yes, definitely. And but, there's a movie being made, James Fox, who with Leslie Keene arranged for that whole thing, the Coalition for Freedom of Information, and don't know what the outcome of that whole business will be. I was pleased that there was some pretty decent coverage of it. You know, going back to the Chicago Tribune story about the O'Hare case from a year ago.
Yes.
And so maybe the world is changing. Maybe some of the media guys will finally treat it seriously. And you know, the political campaign with Dennis Kucinich's sighting coming.
Mm-hmm. That was in Shirley MacLaine's book.
Yeah, but it was also at a press conference.
Yeah.
The debate, I guess, when Russert asked about it. And at least I've seen a couple of newspaper articles that take that seriously and don't think we should be laughing, and that's progress. So I'm still an optimist, George. Despite my advanced age, I'm an optimist.
Well, you know, as I've told a few people on this program, you were the very first interview I did when I was a 21-year-old radio reporter in Detroit. Man.
I was a little younger then, too, George.
You were. You were on the circuit. You were at a college.
Yep.
And then I remember going to the speech at night. I got an email, Stan. This is a funny story. From the guy who set you up at the college, who brought you in. And, you know, Oakland University, I think, if I remember.
Yeah, that sounds right.
It was a great, great, great bit. Look, we've got a minute to go. Stan, very quickly, your website, and then Frank. Go.
www.stantonfriedman.com. That's Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. Tells you how to reach me, to send me, to talk to me, whatever.
How about you, Frank?
Flatwoodsmonster.com, and I want to give a real quick note here. We had some breaking news from West Virginia. Mayor Calloway from the city of St. Albans and Larry Bailey from Brothers Bailey Promotions have given the green light, and we're going to have the 2008 Flatwoods Monster Extravaganza on the actual date, September 12th, 2008, in St. Albans.
Well, maybe if we work it out, we can broadcast coast to coast out of there.
That would be
Why
great.
Not?
And what we're working on, too, George, I have 17 years of research, and the city of St. Albans is working with me, and we're going to put a museum in.
All right, Frank, you get back with our producers. We might be able to work that out if we can get in broadcast line. Stan, thank you, Frank.
Both of you, sir.
You're always a touch of class on this program. For our dear friends Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.